Well, as you can probably tell by that video, that our stewardship series this year is going to play on that famous word you hear in little children, mine, mine. Now, each week we're going to twist it just a little bit. We're going to think about more appealing ways that we can and should say mine. But we start with this idea that all of us begin at that stage. My grandson, Geronimo, who goes by Gio, has hit that stage at warp speed this year. Probably enhanced by the fact that there's a little sister on the scene now, and now that she can crawl and get mobile and get into his stuff. My daughter says, just about every day, you hear Gio say, no, baby Evie, that's mine. My daughter caught this on camera one day. Take a look.
Evie, don't play, that's mine. That's mine, baby.
Gio.
About all I can say to that is he takes after his mother. Kylie Larson on our staff majored in early childhood development. And she points out that while it might not be very appealing to hear a child scream mine, it actually is a healthy sign of development. She said at about 18 months, a number of things start to come together for little children. One, their motor skills are forming. They can grab hold of things. She said they also develop what's called object permanence, which means even though you can't see something, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. In other words, even though my toys are in the other room and I'm not looking at them or holding them, I know that they're there. And then perhaps most importantly, a child at this stage is beginning to understand that I am a me. I'm beginning to self-differentiate and form an understanding of self. Now, a child does not yet at that stage have the ability to take on another's perspective. That will come. At about age 3, they begin to develop the concept of ours. But first things first, you first have to have a me before you can understand we. With that background, how does that help us understand what Paul said in 1 Corinthians? When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. I have long struggled with those words from Paul because Jesus said that unless you become like a child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. But what if Paul is not judging the behavior of little children? What if Paul is reminding us that we're supposed to develop and keep growing? What if he's not condemning the behavior of a child, but saying to us, just don't stay there. We are made to go from me to we. I don't know, that might be giving Paul more benefit of the doubt than is appropriate. But my question would be, is that even necessary? Is it necessary for Paul to remind people of that? I mean, when do you ever see an adult acting like a little child saying, mine? Take a look at this video.
Go, go, go. Hey, hey, clever, hey, clever, 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 cl
That was filmed at a Costco. Two people were fighting over Pokemon cards for children, and others had to step in to try to break up the fight. It's not so cute anymore, is it? It's not so funny. When you see adults in the mind stage of a little child, not only is it not funny, it's dangerous. It's scary when people stay in that stage. So we're not just talking about a psychological development. We're talking about a spiritual development that applies to all people of all ages, to keep moving from me to we. Stephen Hoskins, you heard him on the announcements earlier, is our lay leader here at St. Luke's. And earlier this year, Stephen led the devotion at our governing board meeting one evening. He talked about how leadership is stewardship, how being on that board is an act of stewardship, because the word steward means manager. And we've been given an awesome responsibility to manage the resources of St. Luke's, to manage our human resources, our financial resources, our tangible resources of our building. But then he told a story that he gave me permission to read to you. I want to just read it in his words. It's about his daughter, Nikki. Nikki's now 40 years old and has a family of her own, but when she was a teenager and still living at home, we bought her a car. It was a cute little car, a Mitsubishi Eclipse. She drove herself to school every day. She drove herself to soccer practice after school. And that car gave her the freedom to go see her friends and do whatever she wanted to do. Whenever she wanted to do it, she loved it, and we were happy for her. But one day, I had to take my car in to have it repaired. I told Nikki I needed to use the Eclipse to drive to work. "But, Dad," she said, "that's my car." Now think about that for a minute. We bought the car, we paid for the insurance, we paid for all the maintenance on it, and we even paid for the gas that she used in it. But it was somehow her car. Of course it was. We had bought it for her, and we were more than happy to do so. So when she said, "But Dad, that's my car," I just smiled and said, "Yes, sweetie, it sure is. But we're a family, and everything we have is for the whole family to use, like our house that we live in. It's for the whole family. And your bedroom, which, by the way, will go to your little brother one day when you go off to college, and even that Eclipse. The truth is that we as a family actually own that car, and you're a steward of it. We want you to use it, and we know you'll take good care of it, but right now I need it to drive to work so I can pay for all this. So I'll be glad to drop you off at school on my way." Well, she didn't like that very much, but she accepted it grudgingly. I don't think that lesson really sank in for her at the time, but it did sink in just recently. Just in the past few months, her son, my grandson, turned 16. And they bought him a car to drive to school and to drive to hockey practice. Sound familiar? It's a Nissan Altima, and it's a really nice little car. He loves it, and they're happy they could do it for him. But guess what? When Nikki needs to drive to Chicago every week for her business meetings, she drives Parker's Altima instead of her SUV because it uses less gas and it's easier to park. Do you see what happened there? Now she's the parent, and she's on the flip side of that stewardship equation. Now it's her family who is the owner, and it's Parker who is the steward. It makes a lot more sense to her now. It's not about ownership. It's about stewardship. There's a spiritual progression that we're to experience in life that's not just about psychological development. It's about spiritual development. When we move from me to we. And it happens when we realize that we're a part of something bigger than ourselves. We're a part of a family. And a family is not just the source of provision for our own wants and needs. Our family is the people to whom we have a commitment, to whom we can be a provision of blessing. And when we discover that our family is everyone, all God's children, all people are part of our family. And we hear God come to us one day and say, your family needs you. Oh, that's a big day. That's a big day. Because that's the day that we go from my gifts to my gifts. We see that progression in the life of Moses. The catalyst was a question, a simple question put to Moses. What's in your hand? Moses had been on quite a spiritual journey. He was raised in Pharaoh's household. He lived a royal life. Moses was privileged and provided for. But as Moses matured, he became unsettled because he started to realize that his privilege had come at the expense of other people, that the wealth of his nation had been built on the backs of slaves. And not only that, his identity was tied to these slave people. He was a Hebrew. And one day something snapped inside of Moses. He saw an Egyptian soldier beating a Hebrew slave, and he lunged at the person and killed him. Now Moses is unsafe among his own people, the Egyptians. And so he flees and he goes to the land of Midian. He meets a woman and settles down on land provided by his father-in-law Jethro, and he raises sheep. Now, Moses' fortunes have vastly changed, but you get the sense that Moses would have been content to live out his days staying there in Midian, taking care of sheep and raising a family. He would have been content until the day he heard from God. He saw a bush burning on the mountainside, and he went to investigate. And in that investigation, he experienced God saying to him, go back to Egypt and tell Pharaoh to let my people go. He was saying to Moses, tell him to let your people go. This is your family. Moses, your family needs you. Well, that was a daunting request. Moses did not see himself as gifted enough to carry out such a task. He even said, they may not believe me or listen to me. And that's when the question came. What's in your hand? What was in Moses' hand was his shepherd's staff. And God said, lay it down. And when Moses laid down the staff, it became a serpent. And God said, now grab it by the tail. And when Moses grabbed it by the tail, it became a staff again. I heard Rick Warren give an address years ago called Leadership is Stewardship, much like our lay leader talked to our governing board that night. Except Rick Warren focused on this part in the story of Moses, and he suggested that Moses' staff represented three things. First of all, it symbolized Moses' identity. He was, after all, now a shepherd. He wasn't a prince anymore. He was a shepherd. It symbolized his income. Shepherding was the source of Moses' resources. And it symbolized his influence. A shepherd's staff is how you direct the sheep. What God was saying to Moses is lay down your identity, your income, your influence. And when he did, it came to life by God's power. What's in your hand? God asked that question of every person at some point in life, and for most of us, over many periods of our lives. God asks us that question, but he does not force the answer. We don't have to lay it down. We can keep a hold of it, just like Moses could have kept a hold of it. He could have said, thanks, but no thanks. I'll be content dying an old man here in Midian with my wife and my children around me. That's what I'm going to do. But if he had held on to his staff, what would Moses have missed? He became the greatest of the prophets in the Bible. And what would his family have missed if Moses had been unwilling to lay it down? What we see in this story is what can get in the way of our being able to lay down the sources of who we are, the blessings, the privileges of what we have to be stewards over in the first place. And often what makes us cling a hold of something and say mine is not really selfishness, even though that plays a part sometimes. The greater obstacle is fear. Fear. Moses had to get over being afraid to lay down that staff. What if I lay down my resources, Lord, and I don't have enough? What if what I give is going to end up being a waste of time? What if I take this step of risk and I'm not good enough and people laugh at me? But he would never know the answer until he laid it down. An author named Stephen Pressfield wrote a book called The War of Art. Isn't that a great title? The War of Art. It's kind of a history of art, but in this book, the author points out that Hitler was a painter who never painted. He could not get over the fear of the blank canvas. Did he really have the skills to be a true painter? What if people laughed at his creations? And Pressfield suggests that it was easier for Hitler to start World War II than to stare at a blank canvas. Ooh. That illustration has depth to it. That fear is something that can cause us to regress and go backward in our own spiritual development. And when we go backward and we retreat to that mind stage, it's not just that we can become selfish, it's that we become dangerous. Because other people will become one of two things for us when we say mine. They will either be obstacles or assets. Other people will simply be obstacles who get in the way of our getting what we want or what we need, and therefore they have to be removed. Just look at the Costco video. Or they become assets who help us get what we want or what we need. Either way, obstacle or asset, people become objects. People just simply become objects. They don't become family. They don't become people to whom we sense a relational commitment, a sense of understanding and unity in our common humanity. People who can be the sources of joy and life and love, they don't become that until we move from me to we. That's an important progression. What's in your hand? That's where stewardship begins. Stewardship begins recognizing, no matter who we are, we've all got something. Not just possessions and tangible things. We've got influence. We've got opportunity to serve, opportunity to give. Our job is not to evaluate, is it effective enough? It's not that. It's just to say, will you lay it down when God comes asking? Because when we do, God will bring it to a source of life that will make what we have a source of value that we can't make on our own. In other words, as odd as it is to say, when we lay down what we have, God will make it more valuable to us. Let me close with a story I heard from my colleague, Dr. Phil Schrader, this week. I was with my cohort of other pastors around the country. We meet twice a year. Phil is the senior pastor of Dunwoody United Methodist Church in the Atlanta area, which is where Eric Burton Krieger is on staff. When Eric and his wife moved to Atlanta, the next time I was meeting with the group, I said, Phil, I need you to know about this guy coming down here. He didn't waste any time. Got Eric on the staff. Well, it's really turned out well for me because Phil does favors for me all the time now. He picks me up at the airport. He brings me gifts. He says, Rob, I can't do enough for you for introducing me to Eric. So Eric continues to be a source of blessing in my life. I'm really glad I made that introduction. Anyway, Phil's driving me to the airport the other day, and he's telling me about this 8-year-old kid in his church who is on his little school football team, and he's gotten so excited about church. Somehow the faith has just come to life for him. Worship, children's ministry, he's coming to an awareness of how important he is to God. So he came to Phil recently and he said, I want to be baptized. He had never been baptized as an infant. So one Sunday, they scheduled the baptism, and Phil says every time they baptize someone, they give them one of these palm crosses. You know, you hold it in the palm of your hand. It's made of olive wood. Many of them come from the Holy Land. So he gave, his name is Garrett. He gave Garrett a palm cross that he just thought the world of. Kept it with him all the time. And then not long after that, he received an email from Garrett. Apparently, he lost his cross, and he was asking for another. But here's the email he sent. Dear Pastor Phil, recently while I was at the school during gym, I suppose we were out on the football field, and that cross you gave me at baptism fell out of my pocket while playing football. It was today I think I saw it again, but not in my hands. I saw it in one of my friend's hands. He was fiddling with a cross that looked exactly like mine, worn, marks, and all. I asked him, that's cool. Where did you find it? He replied, oh, it was at the football field. I had suspicions that it was mine, but I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for it because I thought it looked like it brought him closer to God. I'm writing to ask if I could get a replacement of my cross because it's helped me during critical times like tests and other stressful activities. Yeah, sometimes kids show us what it sounds like to say, "Mine." But sometimes kids also show us what it looks like to say, "Mine." What's in your hand?